This hour's top stories: Palestinian resistance movement Hamas calls for the formation of a unified front to counter Israel's demolition of homes in the occupied West Bank. French police arrest nearly 150 demonstrators in Paris who were protesting against police violence and a controversial security bill. So in the headlines, the UN chief urges world leaders to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries to spur action to avoid catastrophic global warming. Welcome to the program. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has raised the alarm about a hike in Israel's demolition of Palestinian homes. Hamas says the demolitions amount to an all-out war on Palestinians. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed that issue in detail.
Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has called for the formation of a unified front to counter Israel's demolition of homes in the occupied West Bank. Now, a Hamas spokesperson said regime's demolition drives represent an all-out war on Palestinians, which needs to be countered by adopting a joint strategy. Hazem Qassem said a hike in razing Palestinian homes shows regime is gradually implementing its plans of annexation. He noted rise comes on the heels of U.S.-brokered normalization deals between Israel and a number of Arab states. According to the UN, over 50 buildings have been razed by Israeli forces over the past 2 weeks in the occupied West Bank. And now joining us for this news review is Zafar Bangesh, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us from Toronto, Canada, and Kay Pritzker, journalist at Breakthrough News, joining us from New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast. We'll start there in Canada and head down south. We'll start with you, Mr. Zafar Bangesh. Your initial thoughts on this, Zafar, and why do you think, I mean, the demolition drives have been blasted by the UN, by the Europeans, but we don't hear anything in terms of sanctions or anything with any teeth to get the Israelis to stop what they're doing. Why?
Well, basically, because the Zionist state of Israel is the illegitimate child of the Western world. It's, in fact, a Western beachhead right in the heartland of Islam, and in particular in the Holy Land. And what we witness is the home demolitions that are going on in the West Bank, as well as in Jerusalem, incidentally. There are at least 700 Palestinians in East Jerusalem that are under threat of eviction. And there is a particularly virulent group of Zionist settlers by the name of Atarat Kohanim that has been at the forefront of pushing the Palestinians out of their homes and taking them over forcibly. And if the Palestinians don't leave, then they even actually, unfortunately, the courts in Israel are all on the sides of the Israeli settlers, and so they even fine the Palestinian homeowners and demand of them that they should even pay rent. So to answer your question directly as to why there is no protest or no voices being raised against home demolitions, it is because the Western world, the governments in the Western world, are all in league with the Zionist state of Israel.
Thank you, Zafar. And Kipretzer, okay, I want you, if you could, get into this dimension of it. Tell us how these recent normalization deals with certain Arab countries have impacted what we're seeing taking place. We've always seen the mistreatment of Palestinians, but to have them on a daily basis having their homes razed and becoming homeless in the cold right now and this pandemic, tell us how that all ties together.
Yeah, the normalization is incredibly dangerous, and it just shows how far a lot of these Arab states have retreated. And, you know, I would add, I don't think a lot of the people in countries like the UAE or in Saudi Arabia support the actions of their governments trying to normalize relations with Israel. But, you know, these governments do it largely because of money and because of trade and finance. You know, they're willing to sell out their Arab sisters and brothers. They're willing to sell out the Palestinian cause. And, you know, it's the colonization, it's the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that has caused such a humanitarian crisis in Palestine and has deprived so many people of jobs and of a way to make a living. And Israel, which has profited through that colonization, Israel, which has, you know, built all these advanced industries on top of that stolen land, is now leveraging that technology, leveraging that wealth to strike these trade deals with, you know, these countries. So, you know, I don't think we can rely on the leadership of these countries to fight for the Palestinians. It has to be people.
Thank you. And Zafra, would you like to weigh in on that, how you feel normalization deals and Donald Trump's attitude towards Benjamin Netanyahu, let him do what he wants with impunity, over the last 4 years has impacted the treatment of Palestinians?
Yes, of course. Donald Trump is obviously the most pro-Israeli president in the United States, although unfortunately every president of the United States has been pro-Israel, and that's how Israel gets away with all these horrendous crimes. But Donald Trump has been much more so. In May of 2018, he, you know, moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which is in fact illegal under international law. The world does not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And now we see this situation with Trump pushing these illegitimate Arab regimes into normalizing relations with Israel.
Thank you, Mr. Bengesh. And Pritzker, I'm going to let you get the last word. Key, tell me something. If you're a Palestinian, perhaps a Bedouin or any Palestinian residing in the West Bank, occupied West Bank for that matter, and then, you know, you want to build a dwelling, you go and try to get the proper permit time and again. You go, there's an Israeli sitting across from you, you know, doing your paperwork for you, helping get your stuff resolved, but you don't get the permit. Time and again, you don't get the permit. And when you finally get frustrated and go ahead and put the dwelling up on land that's been yours and your family's for not dozens but hundreds of years, it gets raised by Israeli authorities because of a lack of permit. If this is not systematic ethnic cleansing, what is?
No, I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's ethnic cleansing. You know, Israel could not be founded without creating an artificial Jewish majority on an Arab land. So the only way they could even create the illegitimate state of Israel is through ethnic cleansing. And yeah, you know, I think the only solution for this, as the previous guest said, is for the people in these countries to resist the dictates of, you know, their monarchs and their leaders. But also, you know, at least in the United States, I mean, I'm a supporter of the BDS movement, and I think everyone in the world should be a supporter of the BDS movement, because clearly Israel is not responsive to international law. They're not responsive to any sort of decency. So the only thing we really can do is pressure them by boycotting Israeli goods, by calling for sanctions and divestment from the Israeli government, and pressure the end of the Israeli apartheid regime, just like was done to the South African apartheid regime.
All right, gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Thank you, Mr. Zafar Bengesh, there joining us from Toronto, Canada, and Keith Pritzker, that is, joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for this segment of Europe News Review.
Welcome back. French riot police have arrested nearly 150 demonstrators who were protesting against police violence and a controversial security bill in Paris. Hundreds of Parisians and the press freedom activists took to the streets to protest against the bill. Police used water cannon to disperse the protesters. The bill would increase the government's surveillance tools and restricts rights on circulating images of police officers in the media and online. France has been hit by a wave of street protests after the government introduced the bill in Parliament. The move is part of President Emmanuel Macron's drive to get tougher on law and order ahead of the 2022 elections. In a recent U-turn, Macron's ruling party said it would rewrite the article.
After the controversial law on global security and the massive protest against it, the French government has approved another controversial bill, this time called Law on Separatism, provoking again a popular protest. Prime Minister Castex openly said that this bill targets what he called radical Islam, enemy of the Republic. President Emmanuel Macron has promoted the bill to target separatists undermining the nation.
I have the impression that Islamophobia is an important electoral trading issue. I don't think that Marine Le Pen will win the elections, but to prevent that, the actual government is playing on the ground of the far right.
A rarely seen police cordon surrounded the demonstration entirely from the beginning till the end. Every 100 meters, the police charged the demonstration and made arrests. Some were wounded. Macron had said that the presumed radical black bloc has to be destroyed. Therefore, the police had clear orders, zero tolerance. However, this time, the violence did not come from the demonstrators. Human rights groups have raised concerns over the law, saying it would discriminate and stigmatize French Muslims.
There's so much ambiguity in the formulation of the bill that anyone can be accused of anything anytime. The head of police can dissolve any association on any grounds. With this law, justice does not exist anymore. The democratic state does not exist anymore. Anyone who is a bit annoyed by Muslims can use this law in an arbitrary way. It has to be abolished, same as the law on global security.
The bill in question requires that everyone strictly respects the French Republican principles of secularism, whatever that might mean. The funding of Muslim associations and mosques will be closely monitored. The main association in defense of Muslims, the CCIF, was dissolved. All organizations will have to sign a declaration on secularism if they want to receive funds from the state. In case of non-compliance, they would have to refund the money.
The new bill will be discussed in the French Parliament. Members of the majority party already declared that they want to modify the text. Some want to soften it, others want to make it even more restrictive. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
UN Chief Antonio Guterres has called on world leaders to declare states of climate emergency in their countries.
If we don't change course, we may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of more than 3 degrees this century. Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders
worldwide to declare... Guterres said if the world fails to change course, it may be headed for a catastrophic temperature rise of over 3 Celsius degrees this century. He was speaking at a summit on the 5th anniversary of the Paris Climate Accord that aims to tackle global warming. U.S. President-elect Biden sent a written statement to the virtual summit. He pledged to rejoin the Paris Accord on the first day of his presidency.
If we don't
the
change
U.S.
course.
Withdrew from the international agreement in 2017 under incumbent President Donald Trump. The country is the world's second largest polluter after China. Environmental activist Jody Grage says wealth and prosperity means nothing if the earth becomes uninhabitable.
Independence, success, consumerism, all those things are not going to mean a thing when our world, as our world approaches being uninhabitable. It seems to me that we need to really get behind the groups and people who are working for it. Well, one of the problems, of course, is that both the Democrats and Republicans accept an awful lot of money from people who have a vested interest in doing things that are very bad for climate change. The oil industry, the military-industrial complex, big manufacturers, let's get our economy running. There is going to be a lot of push on Joe Biden to remember the basics.
A UK government source reiterates that the European Union's current offer on a post-Brexit trade deal remains unacceptable to Britain. The source says the British Prime Minister will leave no stone unturned during the process. He said Boris Johnson, however, is clear that any agreement must be fair and respect the position that the UK will be a sovereign nation in 3 weeks. Talks between Britain and the European Union on a post-Brexit deal continued overnight. The main source of contention between the two sides remains fishing rights, economic fair play, and dispute settlement. The two sides have set a deadline of Sunday to find an agreement and prevent a chaotic break. Austria's constitutional court has overturned a ban against headscarves in elementary schools. The court said the ban, which was approved by parliament last year, violates the principle of equality and runs the risk of marginalizing Muslim girls. The ruling is seen as a victory for Austria's Muslim community. Homa Lesgi is in Vienna.
In a move lauded by Austria's Muslim community, the National Constitutional Court has officially lifted the ban on headscarves at elementary schools. The controversial ban, approved last year by the previous conservative right-wing coalition government, has now been ruled unconstitutional. The court's president says it singles out the religion of Islam unjustifiably, goes against the religious and ideological neutrality of the state, and violates the principle of equality.
The selective ban could have an adverse effect on the inclusion of students and lead to discrimination. It excludes Islamic origin and tradition and carries the risk of making it difficult for Muslim girls to access education and could marginalize them from society.
Austria's Islamic faith community, which had filed a complaint about the ban in January, welcomed the ruling, saying it would end a populist prohibition policy.
We are against constraints and prohibitions because, as it is said in the Holy Quran, there is no compulsion in the matter of faith. Our trust in the rule of law and our patience have paid off.
The ban prevented girls up to the age of 10 from wearing headscarves in school.
I think this is a big step forward because schoolgirls are often discriminated because of their hijab, and with this new rule they should be able to live it out freely and without any discrimination, even if it's by other school students or teachers. So I think it's kind of a part of a revolution.
While the opposition Social Democrats, the Liberals and the Greens all welcomed the decision, members of the Conservative ruling party called it regrettable, and the right-wing Freedom Party even suggested attempts to reinstate it. The ban's proponents argued they were protecting young girls from being pressured into observing the hijab.
But Muslim families deny this allegation, saying using force against girls who choose to wear the headscarf undermines efforts to give them equal opportunities and self-determination. And this time, they've won the argument. Homa Lesgi, Vienna.
The number of coronavirus infections in the Netherlands has seen its biggest daily increase since October. According to official data, COVID cases in the Netherlands jumped by more than 9,000 over the past 24 hours. That raises the country's total infections to more than 600,000. The disease has so far claimed over 10,000 lives in the Netherlands. Also on Saturday, Italy's virus deaths jumped by nearly 650 to above 64,000. The country has now reclaimed the record from the UK for the highest number of coronavirus deaths across Europe. The continent has been struggling with a second wave of the disease for several weeks now. Earlier, Max Civili joined us with the latest on the coronavirus outbreak in Italy. Here's what he had to say.
The contagion rate has slowed, and also the number of new hospital admissions has been going down in recent weeks. But, as you said before, Italy is still reporting more daily COVID-19 fatalities than any other European nation. The obvious questions for many Italians are, has the country's healthcare system failed to protect the elderly? Has the government done all it was necessary to tackle the pandemic as it delayed imposing new restrictions? Bear in mind that the average age of Italian victims stands at around 80, and 6 out of 10 COVID-19 dead had 3 or more other health problems before they tested positive, hypertension, diabetes, lung issues. Germany, it has a similarly old demographic, and yet its death toll is one-third of Italy's, despite its larger population of 83 million. It has 21,000 dead overall. So basically, Italy has to ask itself why Germany is doing much better.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President-elect Joe Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd J. Austin III, a former commander of the American military forces in Iraq, to be the next Secretary of Defense, according to two people with knowledge of the selection. If confirmed by the Senate, General Austin would make history as the first African-American to lead the country's 1.2 million active duty troops and the enormous bureaucracy that backs them up. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Helen Cooper, Jonathan Martin, and Eric Schmidt. The piece is titled, Biden Plans to Tap Lloyd Austin, Former Iraq Commander, as Defense Secretary. President-elect Joe Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd J. Austin III, a former commander of the American military forces in Iraq, to be the next Secretary of Defense, according to two people with knowledge of the selection. If confirmed by the Senate, General Austin would make history as the first African-American to lead the country's 1.3 million active-duty troops and the enormous bureaucracy that backs them up. General Austin, 67 years old, was for years a formidable figure at the Pentagon and is the only African-American to have headed the U.S. Central Command, the military's marquee combat command, with responsibility for Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Syria, most of the places where the United States is currently at war. General Austin is known as a battlefield commander, but he is less known for his political instincts, and has sometimes stumbled in congressional hearings, including a session in 2015, when he acknowledged, under testy questioning, that the Pentagon's $500 million program to raise an army of fighters in Syria had gone nowhere. He was selected over another frontrunner, Michelle Flourney, who had served in senior Pentagon policy jobs and mentored a generation of women in national security who had pushed for her appointment as the first female defense secretary. Joe Biden, who is meeting with NAACP leaders on Tuesday, was facing pressure from the Congressional Black Caucus and other black officials to name an African-American to run the Pentagon or the Justice Department. But he skipped over Jay Johnson, a former Secretary of Homeland Security and former General Counsel at the Pentagon, considered by many to be more politically astute pick for the first black man to head the Defense Department. It was unclear on Monday night, 7th of December, what tipped the scales for General Austin. People close to the transition noted that during the Obama presidency, Joe Biden was unhappy with the high profile of the Pentagon, with generals like David Petraeus gaining near rock star status, and the belief that the Pentagon rolled President Barack Obama into increasing troop numbers in Afghanistan. General Lloyd Austin's lower profile, those people suggested, may match with Joe Biden's hopes for a more muted Defense Department. Still, General Austin may face some pushback from lawmakers who feel strongly about civilian control of the military and do not think a retired general can make the transition. Like Jim Mattis, who was President Trump's first defense secretary, General Austin would have to get a congressional waiver to serve, since he has been out of the military for only 4 years. And American law requires a 7-year waiting period between active duty and becoming Pentagon chief. It is not assured that General Austin would get the waiver from lawmakers. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Armed Services Committee, had indicated that Jim Mattis's confirmation that he would oppose future waivers for the post. But for Mr. Reed to reject the first African-American nominated to be defense secretary after approving Jim Mattis would be notable. General Austin, who retired as a four-star general in 2016 after 41 years of military service, is respected across the Army, especially among African-American officers and enlisted soldiers, as one of the rare black men to crack the glass ceiling that has kept the upper ranks of the military largely the domain of white men. Some 43% of active duty troops in the U.S. Army are people of color, but the people making crucial decisions are almost entirely white and male. Supporters say General Austin broke through the barrier thanks to his experience, to his intellect and mentorship of a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, who plucked him to direct the staff of the Joint Chiefs Office. After that, General Austin continued to rise in the ranks. He was named commander of the Central Command by President Obama in 2013. Shortly after the 3rd of November 2020 election, General Austin took part in online session with Joe Biden. Joe Biden had a session with former national security officials, and General Austin took part. During that meeting, General Austin impressed Mr. Biden, according to aides. His selection was reported by the website Politico. After retiring, General Austin joined the board of defense contractor Raytheon Technologies, a fact that garnered criticism on Monday night. "Oh, come on, a general and Raytheon board," said Danielle Bryan, the executive director of the Project on Government Oversight, in a Twitter post. "Possibly the worst of all options. Bad news for civilian control and any real distance from the military-industrial complex." But his supporters point to a long career in combat command, including some of the most difficult assignments recently. Despite overseeing the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq after a bloody war, General Austin showed little interest in the public-facing parts of the job. He avoided speaking publicly or with members of the news media, allowing others to take the lead in the messaging as the war came to an end.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and here is a bezel of a wisdom from the gateway to knowledge, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Meet people in such a manner that if you die, they weep for you. And if you are alive, they long for you. That is, your company.
Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. My brothers and sisters in faith, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. One of the sufferings in life, and one that Islam does not overlook, as a matter of fact, discusses it thoroughly and often, is the matter of poverty. Unfortunately, it's something that so many of us are struggling with. And even though we are taught to be content with what Allah decrees for us, we are also taught to strive and try for the best. There are certain ways that one can change a situation of destitute and deprivation, which Islam teaches us. We will talk about that after a short story regarding one of our great scholars. So we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, so welcome to this program entitled Lantern. We have a new and interesting story for today. What's the title? The Sacrifice of Muhaqqiq Ardabili, one of the great scholars in the Islamic world. It is related that Muhaqqiq Ardabili, during the times of the famine, used to give away to the poor whatever he had. He used to live in poverty himself. One day, when he had donated all his possessions, his wife became angry with him that he had deprived his children in such times when food was scarce. He left his home and went to the mosque and sat there in i'tikaf. An unknown person arrived at the door of his house and handed sacks of wheat and flour, saying that Master Ardabili sent it and that he was in i'tikaf at the mosque of Kufa. When Muhaqqiq Ardabili returned home from i'tikaf, his wife told him that he had sent very fine wheat and flour. When he learned of the details, he realized that it was a divine favor upon him, and he fell down in prostration to thank the Almighty. Many times it was seen that Muhaqqiq left home with an expensive turban, but if he encountered a beggar, he tore a piece from it and gave it in alms. On numerous occasions, he returned home bareheaded.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So the story was the story of Muhaqqiq Ardabili, and he was a great man. I mean, it's not just through this story. He has written volumes and volumes of books, and he has paved the way for many more discoveries and deeper understandings of our religion, and has established milestones for those who would come in future generations. However, the focus of today's story is regarding his generosity. And this is actually one of the attributes of all great men and women. Generosity is, a matter of fact, one of the qualities of the prophets and apostles. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are known for their generosity. Just to understand the importance of generosity, during the time of the noble prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, there were a group of people who, like disbelievers, who were plotting to assassinate his holiness. And through revelation, Rasulullah was made aware of their scheme, and it was foiled, and they failed, and they were all killed save one. The person who was spared later on approached Rasulullah and asked him that I was among those people who were planning to kill you as well. We sharpened our swords, we wanted to come attack you, whatever the case was. But why did you not kill me? Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said to him that, now he was addressing his potential murder, not even potential. They fought and his allies were killed. So Rasulullah was talking to his murderer. But this is the beauty of Rasulullah's outlook on life. He always saw the best in everything and everyone, and he cherished it, and he cultivated it, and he turned that person into the best version of themselves. Rasulullah spoke to this man who was planning to kill him and said, "You have five qualities within you that I love and Allah loves. Among those qualities was generosity. You have karam. You are a giver." And that's very important, brothers and sisters, for us to be generous even during times that we barely have enough for ourselves. A man once came to Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam and said to him that I have a lot of kids and I'm incredibly poor and we barely have anything to eat and I'm struggling to make ends meet and put bread on the table, and I just don't know what to do anymore. I'm so hopeless and we're in despair, and please help us and this and that. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam told him that if you have a loaf of bread, say there are five of you, cut that loaf of bread into six pieces and give one piece to charity. And the guy was like, "We don't have anything to eat. I'm telling you, we're poor. You're telling me to give a piece of bread away to others?" And Imam al-Sadiq said that, "Trust me, do it, and Allah will increase your provision." He did it for a few days, maybe a week or so, I don't exactly know. And he came back to Imam al-Sadiq afterwards and said, "Yes, Yabna Rasulullah, O son of the Prophet of God, you were right. It is through giving to others that we open the channels of Allah's blessings and favors toward ourselves." That's just how the system works. Because charity is an indication, a sign, and a manifestation of gratefulness. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said in the Holy Quran that لَإِن شَكَرْتُمْ لَأَزِيدَنَّكُمْ. If you are grateful, I will increase you. I will increase for you. And by giving to others, I'm giving thanks to Allah, because I am valuing this blessing that He has given to me. I'm not belittling it by saying, "Oh, it's barely enough for us. How can I possibly share it with others?" What I express in my actions and in my conduct, that I value this blessing that Allah has given to me, and whatever it is, because it's from Allah, it's in abundance. It is kathir. It is a lot of khair. It is a lot of goodness. And I acknowledge that, and I'm going to spread this goodness with others. And once Allah sees that sense of gratitude in us, that contentment that we have, even if it's little, we don't see it as little, we see it as a lot, because it's from our beloved, He increases it for us so that we may share more, we may spread more, and we may grow more. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
It was just after the horrendous murder of Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul that this name reached the ears of the public, the Firqatul Nimr, or the Tiger Squad, a Saudi hit team under the guidance and supervision of Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince and de facto leader. The squad is said to be made up of 50 operatives, the best ones recruited from different branches of the kingdom's security services, who have one thing in common: blind loyalty to their leader. The Tiger Squad has one major mission: eliminating Saudi dissidents at home and abroad in a way unnoticed by the media and the international community. In this regard, the Khashoggi case was a disaster for the group. According to the New York Times, the Death Squad was involved in more than a dozen operations from 2017, since the rise of bin Salman, to the killing of the Saudi journalist. Some members of the squad had received special training in Arkansas as part of the U.S.-Saudi cooperation, according to the Washington Post.
The Saudis are very good corporate customers, especially with buying of military equipment. I believe they have the third largest military budget in the world. A lot of this equipment just sits rotting in warehouses because the Saudis can't use it or don't know how to use it. They spend more on their military than the Russians do. This buys a lot of friends in the American system. And as far as what we've been hearing about this, frankly, here in the American media, you don't hear much about this at all, that there is some criticism of the Saudis. But by and large, most of these activities are passed over in silence by the mainstream media, who are themselves part of the same establishment, which has a very cozy relationship with the Saudis. Also take into account what appears to be a very close personal partnership between Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. They've got a lot of cover for these activities, where people in powerful places are going to protect them.
The Tiger Squad's mission is reportedly killing Saudi critics, not abducting or arresting them. In the words of a Saudi source, the Saudi leadership have the belief that arresting critics will mount pressure on them, so that's why they started assassinating them quietly. The squad's assassination methods vary, but the aim is to show the assassinations as accidents, such as a car crash or house fire. A few hours after a dozen princes, ministers, and business people were locked up in the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton Hotel, the Tiger Squad carried out one of its first known operations at home in early November 2017, targeting Prince Mansour bin Mukran, an opponent of Mohammed bin Salman, when he was fleeing the country by helicopter. The prince was reportedly killed by Mashal Saad al-Bastani. According to the Middle East Eye source, Bastani was a lieutenant in the Saudi Royal Air Force, and he shot down Mansour's helicopter with a missile from another helicopter, but they made it seem like a natural death. Ironically, Bastani himself was reportedly killed in a car accident in Riyadh. The Mecca Public Court's president, Sheikh Soliman Abdul Rahman Al Thunayan, was another victim of the Tiger Squad. A critic of bin Salman's 2030 vision, an ambitious economic plan, Al Thunayan was reportedly killed by deadly viruses being injected into his body during a normal medical checkup in early October 2018.
I think what's special is are the refined capabilities. It's one thing to have the kind of, let's say, blunt force terror that really started with the very beginning of the Saudi regime in the 1920s, when they first created this. This is currently the third Saudi state. But in a way, and maybe this shouldn't be put this way, but it kind of reminds me of the kind of hit squads the Israelis have used in the past. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there was some cooperation, communication, maybe even patterning this hit squad on what the Israelis have turned into an art form for many decades.
The Tiger Squad has had two unsuccessful operations in Canada. In one of these operations in 2018, the Saudi dissident Omar Abdulaziz, a friend of Khashoggi, who lives in exile in Canada, was approached before the killing of his friend by Saudi officials who urged him to visit their embassy with them to collect a new passport.
It seems that one of their techniques is to lure people into a place, for example, like the Turkish, the Saudi embassy, or excuse me, consulate in Istanbul, to commit their crimes. So it seems to be that this, look, the Saudi regime has a long history of violence, repression, murder, torture, and so forth, but this seems to be a new refinement of it to have a dedicated hit squad that can perform these activities.
Abdulaziz refused to go to the consulate, and the operation failed. But the Saudi authorities arrested two of his brothers and several of his friends back at home. Another unsuccessful operation by the Tiger Squad intended to do away with Saad al-Jabri, a former senior Saudi intelligence figure residing in Toronto. According to a 106-page lawsuit filed August 6, 2020, in the District Court in Washington, the hit squad failed in its bid to get past Canadian border guards at Pearson International Airport to eliminate al-Jabri. As the mission was thwarted, on bin Salman's orders, al-Jabri's children, who had long been prevented from leaving the kingdom, were arrested in March 2020. They've been held hostage since then, and their location and condition are unknown.
I think the existence of this squad shows that he is a ruthless and dangerous person, and that he is willing. Look, I think we've seen this in other areas as well. For example, his dogged pursuit of conquering Yemen, despite the fact that that hasn't happened, he is willing to use whatever means at his disposal to accomplish his ends, and that they're, like I say, what seems to be new about this is not just the bloodthirstiness or the ruthlessness that has characterized the Saudis for decades, but the ability to refine this now with a way that can be targeted in a more precise way. Look, obviously, he is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has to have a not only a degree of intelligence, but a huge degree of ambition, that he is willing to use whatever means at his disposal to accomplish his regional goals and his goals within Saudi Arabia. We saw this, by the way, also with his mass imprisoning people, including members of the royal family, some of them tortured in order to make them cough up their assets. This is not the kind of thing, I don't think we've seen this even in Saudi Arabia before.
The lawsuit claims that as its first order of business, the squad kidnapped the prince in Europe via private jet and brought him back to Saudi Arabia, where he was detained and tortured. It is said that when Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered at the consulate, members of the Tiger Squad sent the journalists' fingers to Riyadh as the trophy of their successful mission and a present to the Saudi Crown Prince who had reportedly threatened to cut off the fingers of every writer who dared criticize him. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Increasing numbers of children are going hungry in the United States as it weathers the world's worst coronavirus outbreak, which has killed around 280,000 people and caused a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. According to the Commerce Department, nearly 12% of adults said that they lived in a household where there was not enough to eat sometimes or often last month. A Brookings Institution survey found 10% of mothers reported their children under the age of 5 went hungry to some degree in October and November. Non-profit Feeding America estimates over 50 million Americans will be considered food insecure this year, including about 1 in 4 children, reversing gains made in recent years that had brought hunger among children to its lowest level in at least 2 decades. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Pandemic Sends Hunger Rising in U.S. and Children Bear the Brunt. Please stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. Before the coronavirus pandemic closed her middle school and U.S. immigration agents deported her father to El Salvador, Kimberly Orellana did not fear going hungry. But with her mother now alone and cleaning houses for pay that isn't enough to reliably feed Orellana and her 2 younger sisters, the 14-year-old is left to trek to a nearby school for a handout of groceries organized by a non-profit organization. As she ran the errand north of Baltimore on a cold and rainy morning during a break from classes, which are now held online, Orellana said, "Everyone in our family eats. Sometimes we need a little bit of groceries to keep our fridge full." Increasing numbers of children are going hungry in the United States as it weathers the world's worst coronavirus outbreak, which has killed around 280,000 Americans and caused a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, nearly 12% of adults said they lived in a household where there was not enough to eat sometimes or often last month. A Brookings Institution survey found 10% of mothers reported their children under the age of 5 went hungry to some degree during October and November. Non-profit organization Feeding America estimates over 50 million Americans will be considered food insecure this year, including about 1 in 4 children, reversing gains made in recent years that had brought hunger among children to its lowest level in at least 2 decades. Lauren Bauer, an economic studies fellow at the Brookings Institution, told Agence France-Presse, "We feel pretty confident in saying food insecurity right now is the highest on record in the modern era." The numbers are jarring for a country that has the purported world's largest economy, and its officials wrongly claim the country is a major donor of food aid worldwide. Chloe Waterman, a program manager for advocacy group Friends of the Earth, said food and agriculture is about 20% of the US economy, and 100% of people are eaters. The pandemic's March arrival and the business shutdown that followed brought soaring unemployment and a sharp contraction in economic growth. President Donald Trump's downplaying of the coronavirus and U.S. states' uneven response set the stage for ongoing surge in the number of cases and deaths. Schools also shut down, making it complicated for poorer children to get free meals at schools. And Lauren Bauer said, "Runs a grocery store created a shortage of basic goods that put low-income parents further behind." Lauren Bauer added, "The pressure on families to pay for some of those things that the public provides was quite disastrous." Congress responded by allowing states to give families whose children would normally get school meals benefit cards equal to their value, while many school districts also continued providing food that students could eat at home. But Lauren Bauer said there are holes in this safety net, particularly for parents who can't get to where schools are distributing their meals, perhaps because they have jobs as essential workers. There is also a gap for parents with children too young to attend school, the age at which poor nutrition can have lifelong consequences. Chloe Waterman said, "And the government's main program to supposedly provide needy families with food, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, doesn't pay enough to live off, shifting the burden of surging unemployment onto charities." The effects have been felt by the non-profit organization Baltimore Hunger Project, which provides weekend groceries in and around the city of Baltimore for families whose children rely on school meals. The bag of eggs, bread, and other essentials Orellana picks up for her mother and herself, who are undocumented immigrants, and her two sisters, who were born in the United States, at a distribution in Coxville suburb, will last them about 2 weeks. She said, "It's really hard sometimes, but you just got to keep going." Meanwhile, in Washington, the surge in hungry Americans comes amid a controversy over who Joe Biden, who projected by media as the next U.S. president, will pick as the U.S. Agriculture Secretary, a position that would oversee SNAP, that is, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and other nutrition programs. Heidi Heitkamp, a former North Dakota senator, is seen